some reason, the last sheet of the sign-in sheet did not appear. Either it left and you have one of you have it, or I didn't bring it, which is much more likely. So if you are W through Z, your last name starts W through Z, sign the green sheet, and I will reprint.
I'm W, and it was here at the beginning of class. I signed in.
So, yeah, okay, somebody has the last sign-in sheet. Somebody has the last sign. Oh, got it. Okay. It's there. Perfect. Okay, so if you're W through Z, you're cool. Crises of life. Okay, so we got to get going because I think I put too much into the class. There's too many components, and I really want them all to be contiguous, to hang together. So let's start.
All right.
A little bit about mindfulness, and then we'll sit for 10 minutes. First, you can do whatever you consider to be meditation in these 10 minutes. You don't have to do mindfulness. If you're doing mindfulness, there are two non-efforts that you're making. Okay? The first and most important of which is to let go, to open to the present moment, to come out of whatever your predicament or idea about life is, into just relaxing and opening to your existence at this very place and time. So the way I put it is you soften everything. You soften your mind, you soften your heart, you soften your body, you soften your boundaries. And you just open. And you open to your breathing. And you open to just being alive at this moment with all the thoughts, with all the feelings, with all the sensations. And the more profound sense of opening is you open interior to or transcendent to those things. That is, you open to a larger sense of who you are. But you don't find that intellectually. You just release into that. So if you do nothing else, let go of your tensions for 10 minutes, a little, at least to the extent you can. That will be helpful, both helpful and helpful, both mentally and physically. But there is a further step. This isn't just nap time. You know, I told you this before. I told all my stories before. You're going to throw cabbages at me someday, soon. In Zen, you know, the Zen master or the teacher says to you, quit trying so hard. Just take it easy. Stop all the effort. And then you go like this, you know. And then she comes around and she goes, what? Is this nap time? Sit up straight. Pay attention. So that's the tension that we're, the edge we're standing on, we're sitting on. And that edge is the edge between relaxing or opening more and more completely and not spacing out. And not losing consciousness. So step one is the softening and opening. Step two is the development of the witness. And that's where things get a little more subtle. You can't think yourself into being watching thinking. You can't get out of thinking by thinking. So this is not a question of figuring this out or being more clever. It's a question of shifting your attention over and over again from something other than your thought process to something that's happening at present. So most systems around the world say, come to your breathing. Keep returning attention to your breathing over and over and over again. You'll get lost in thought, bring your attention back to your breathing. You get lost in thought, bring your attention back to your breathing. Even in a few minutes, if you keep coming back to your breathing, you'll notice that you lose it every once in a while. Where do you lose it? Into thinking. You come back to your breathing. So every time you come back to your breathing, you become mindful. For a moment, you realize, oh, okay, I was thinking, and now I'm present. And then back into. And then as time goes on, there develops the ability, you rewire your brain such that you can, with a few breaths, take, as Michael Singer says, fall behind your experience. Take one step back from it. So that instead of being the usual you with all its ups and downs, you're that which watches, that which has experience. You're the capacity for experience rather than the experience itself. And that witnessing perspective gives you enormous insight and tremendous freedom from the weather conditions. But again, we're thinking this now. The practice involves coming back, softening and opening, coming back to the breathing over and over and over. And as time goes on, you'll be able to hear your thoughts or see your thoughts without losing your awareness. And you'll go, oh, I'm watching the me show. That's what we're doing. Okay? All right, let's do it. Paula, would you close that one door so that we can... Honey.
If I was asking for experience rather than the experience, and life is about experiencing, how would you respond?
I would say that you're more than the experience. You're also the capacity for experience. So you exist at two levels, the conditional and the unconditional.
Okay.
Experience is important, and it's important to have good experience, but it's also important to realize that that experience is a limited form of who you are. So let's go. Oh, I got to turn off the lights. I'm sorry. Please go ahead. So we'll sit for 10 minutes.
Michael, could you close that door?
I'm going to leave the lights off because we're going to go back and forth between things that I read to you and things that we see on the screen. So it'll be easier. Also, it's nice to leave the lights off. A couple of very brief announcements. First, next week, Dr. Robert Wanderer is going to come to class and not only talk to us, but lead us through exercises having to do with mindfulness, compassion, and emotions. When I introduce her next week, I'll be more formal about it, although I'm not very much more formal. But Rowley studied with remarkable people, including Alan Wallace, who she studies with currently, Jack Kornfield, and I think she's also studied with Paul Ekman. So she's...
And her
husband, Michael Kearney, is amazing. Anyway, you'll come next week if you can. Life stories. Donna, would you say...
Okay. About that far away.
Over the years that many of us have taken this class, we've been encouraged to write a short, like 2-page bio or an anecdote that you wanted to share. And they're collected in that red binder over on the table, and they're also on Robert's website. So you're free to borrow that binder if you bring it back, and also to think about contributing a short story for our collection.
So anything, we just want to hear everybody's voice. So if you want to put a poem in there, put a poem in there. If you want to put an anecdote about your life or your synopsis of your life, put that in there. It'd be nice if everybody's voice were represented.
If you can't hear me, tell me. If you want information about mindfulness or... my voice to guide you through it, go to drspencersherman.com. If you want to hear any past classes, thanks to Michael and Robert, who's at the film festival, go to swt.org/Spencer, and most past classes for the past several years are there. Okay. Last week, we did, at the very end, we did the exercise about reaching a goal. Right? Most of you did that. All this commentary was supposed to come before that exercise, but it works probably better after. So what we're going to be talking about today is how do you succeed? How do you reach important goals in your life? And I'm going to give you 5 viewpoints on that, which should sum to a better understanding of how you get from the bottom of the hill, past the obstacles, to the top of the hill. So first understanding, and you can hear me in the back, all right, Catherine? Yeah, okay, good. First understanding comes from what we may be. Piero Ferrucci's popular book on psychosynthesis, a really wonderful book from which I got the up-the-hill exercise. So the chapter I'm going to read to you from is the chapter on the will. And some of you will remember I read some of this a year ago or so when we did that exercise last. But it's well worth hearing again. I'm not going to read at too great a length here, just some selection about what the will is.
And I think I better do this. True essence can explain a host of human attainments, while its absence can account for legions of psychological disturbances. If understood in its proper perspective, the will is, more than any other factor, the key to human freedom and personal power. In fact, the will can be seen as an expression of what Angel, A-N-G-Y-A-L, prominent earlier psychologist, the will can be seen as an expression of what Angel called autonomy, the capacity of an organism to function freely according to its own intrinsic nature, rather than under the compulsion of external forces. That is, you make up your own mind. In fact, all of evolution can be seen in terms of the emergence of this freedom. That is, going from being determined by your circumstances and by your genetics to more and more freedom to choose your life. Whenever the will of an individual is ignored, suppressed, or violated in a consistent and enduring way, or if it is stillborn or even non-existent, pain and illness arise. Take a look at your own will. Is it frequently pushed around by the will of other people? Subjugated by your feelings, such as depression, anger, or fear? Paralyzed by inertia? Lulled to sleep by habit? Disintegrated by distractions? Corroded by doubts? Do you generally do what you wish from the depths of your being because you willed it, or does some other factor prevail? The key there is from the depth of your being. Do you choose from the depth of your being? Despite many obstacles, the discovery of the will is quite an elementary experience. If we want to facilitate this process, we can start in the simplest of all ways. We can discover or intensify our will by using it. Each moment offers such an opportunity. If we look at it that way, life becomes a laboratory for experimenting with and developing our will. Here are just a few of the ways. Thousands of others could be invented of activating the will in various situations of everyday life. Is this the proper volume for you? Can you hear well?
Yeah.
Right. So here are ways of developing the will in everyday life. Do something that you have never done before. Perform an act of courage. Make a plan and then follow it. Keep doing what you're doing for 5 more minutes, even if you're tired or restless or feel the attraction of doing something else. By the way, you don't have to write these down. I'll have this in the front so you can look at this. Okay. Do something extremely slowly. Say no when it's right to say no, but easier to say yes. Do what seems to you the most important thing to be done. When facing a minor choice, choose without hesitation. Instead of agonizing about, should I eat this today, or should I eat that today? Should I wash this dish now? Should I not wash it? This is the opposite of that. When facing a minor choice, choose without hesitation. Act contrary to all expectations. Behave independently of what other people might think or say. Refrain from saying something you're tempted to say. Postpone an action you would prefer to begin right now. Begin at once an action. action you would prefer to postpone. Perform the same personal growth exercise every day for 1 month, even if it seems totally useless. Eliminate something superfluous from your life. Eliminate everything superfluous.
Nowadays, when you clean something and you go, oh my God, I feel so much better for having that definition than 10 years ago. Anyway.
Break a habit. Do something that makes you feel insecure. Carry out an action with complete attention and intensity, as if it were your last. That's being very mindful of any given action. Any action can be transformed into an exercise of will, provided it's not done from habit or experienced as duty. An avalanche process is thereby set in motion. Once we've discovered our will, it enables us to perform further acts of will. In this way, we increase our reservoir of will and therefore become able to develop it even further. We create a virtuous circle. Will generates will. The experience of real will is not to be confused with Victorian willpower. The fact that many people have been calling will what was actually stern self-restraint should not tempt us to throw out the baby of the true will with the bathwater of Victorian self-denial. We can clear up this misunderstanding as soon as we realize that the real function of the will is to direct, not to impose. The real function of the will is to direct, not to impose. An example to help illustrate this. Let's suppose that you're in a rowboat in the middle of a lake and you want to return to the shore. To do so, you will have to make use of two functions. First, you must decide which direction to steer the boat and maintain that direction. Second, you must use your muscular energy to row the boat. So you decide and then you use your energy. Now suppose, again, that instead of handling the rowboat, you're working a sailboat in a mild breeze. What you need this time is skill in handling the rudder and the sail so as to take advantage of the interplay of natural energies. No muscular effort on your part is required to move the boat. Your only function is to choose and maintain the direction in which you want to sail, a much easier and more relaxing task than that of supplying the propelling force. In the sailboat, you're not an agent, you're a meta-agent. This means that you let the wind, the sail, the waves, and the currents interact with one another. All you have to do is skillfully regulate this interaction without directly participating in it, as you would have done in the rowboat. True will is likewise a meta-agent, or as Alison Elmer Green called it, a meta-force, which can direct the play of the various elements of personality from an independent standpoint, without mingling or identifying with any of them. But we don't usually realize that this is possible. So I'm going to make a comment and go back to this. When he talks about the will just being that which gives direction and organization to the forces which already naturally exist, he sounds like he's talking about Taoism, T-A-O-I-S-M, right? The idea that the superior person doesn't work against the natural flow of things, but rather tunes her or himself to the natural flow of things to know when it is advantageous to take various actions. The metaphor is swimming up or downstream. If you want to get upstream and the current is going downstream, then you use a lot of willpower to kind of fight your way upstream, and it exhausts you when you don't get there. The Taoists say, wait until the current turns, and the tide is coming in, and the flow is upstream, and they just jump in, and the river will carry you with no effort to where you need to go. So the whole philosophy of Taoism is a philosophy of realizing what the conditions are, and then advantageously taking advantage of those conditions, rather than trying to change the conditions and fight one's way through the world. The way we habitually handle ourselves resembles the act of rowing a sailboat when the wind is blowing. We thrash around needlessly, determined to act as agents even when no effort is required of us. We waste so much energy because we not only decide what to do, we also try applying ordinary willpower. But we could accomplish just as much without trying and with much less expenditure of energy. Once, when a conductor, Herbert von Karajan, was coaching his students, he made the distinction between laborious doing and effortless direction in a marvelously clear fashion. He recalled the days when, as a child, he took riding lessons. On the night before his first jump, he was sleepless with worry. How can I lift this enormous thing up into the air over the fence? I thought to myself. Then I realized no one lifts the horse, you just set it in the right direction and it lifts by itself. The orchestra will do the same thing. Do not misunderstand me here. Using the will may at times involve great effort and striving. It may run against our ingrained attitudes and habits. It may be a will that breaks through barriers, overcomes fear, compels even the most improbable things to happen. And it may still be a healthy will, immune from the harsh grimace of willpower and different from it by nature. What makes the difference is identifying with the decision only and not with the action and effort. For this to happen, the will has to spring from the very core of ourselves without being contaminated or deviated by other forces. Just a couple more little additions to this. The best way for us all to offset the danger of trying too hard is to remember that we can truly will only from the center of our being, the self. All other forms of willing are psychological monsters. The will is captivated and distorted by a feeling, a subpersonality, and so on. When it springs from the center, the will can express itself in many different ways and can be regarded as a constellation of inner events rather than a single clear-cut psychological manifestation. At times we
I know what happened. I think the battery ran out there.
Oh, maybe I gave up. No, it's okay.
It's on red, so it might poop out, but I have another one.
At times, we realize the will.
There we go.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I think the other one was.
The cord.
The other one was actually.
If you can just undo the cord, you might.
There.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so, yeah, I think it's much better. All right, at times we realize the will in an instantaneous event, quick as a bolt of lightning. As in the case of a spontaneous act of courage or a sudden decision from which we cannot draw back. At other times, we may experience the will as a steady flow of strength, as when we concentrate our attention on some object independently of our distractions, or when we apply ourselves steadfastly to some project which we want to carry out regardless of the difficulties involved. Roberto Assagioli, who founded Psychosynthesis, talks about seven groups of qualities displayed by the will in action: energy, mastery, one-pointedness, determination, persistence, courage, and organization. That was the preamble to the exercise that you did last week about dealing with obstacles and still willing yourself to continue on that path to your goal. So that's the first section of this argument that I'm constructing. Okay. The second section is a very short TED Talk, which it nags at me that I might have shown some of you a year or so ago. If so, that's fine. It's 7 minutes long and it's worth hearing again. But maybe not. Maybe I didn't show it to you. Anyway, I'm going to show it to you right now. Film festival right here.
Yes, the best one. The Oscar line.
Angela Lee Duckworth is Angela Lee Duckworth is a positive psychologist. She's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She started in the master's program there just a few years ago and rapidly ascended into the firmament of positive psychology stars. This particular TED Talk you can see has almost 6 million views. There's a reason for it. Going to talk about something that, okay, positive psychology, as most of you remember, has identified 24 possible strengths of character. And the prescription is find out the strengths that you're already good at, and then use them more and more in your life, rather than worrying about the weaknesses, the strengths that you're not so good at. So there are 24 possible strengths. Many of us in this class identify our highest strengths. If you didn't do that or want to do it again, you go to authentichappiness.org and I'll show you the question. You take the VIA Survey of Character Strengths questionnaire, authentichappiness.org, and then find the questionnaire that is the VIA Survey of Character Strengths questionnaire. And it will rank for you your 24 strengths from the ones you're highest on to the ones you are not so high on. They don't like to call those weaknesses, they like to call those lesser strengths, but they're weaknesses. Don't spend most of your life trying to fix your weaknesses, it will drain your energy. Spend your life burnishing your strengths, and your weaknesses have a tendency to kind of come along with that, or if you're going to work on your lesser strengths, do so with part of your energy, not most of it. Anyway, what she's going to talk about is around the world the strength that ranks 19th out of 24. This is not something that people are generally good at.
Consulting for a job that was even more demanding, teaching. I went to teach seventh graders math in the New York City public schools. And like any teacher, I gave quizzes and tests, I gave out homework assignments. When the work came back, I calculated grades. What struck me was that IQ was not the only difference between my best and my worst students. Some of my strongest performers did not have stratospheric IQ scores. Some of my smartest kids weren't doing so well. And that got me thinking. The kinds of things you need to learn in seventh grade math, sure, they're hard. Ratios, decimals, the area of a parallelogram. But these concepts are not impossible. And I was firmly convinced that every one of my students could learn the material if they worked hard and long enough. After several more years of teaching, I came to the conclusion that what we need in education is a much better understanding of students and learning from a motivational perspective, from a psychological perspective. In education, the one thing we know how to measure best is IQ. But what if doing well in school and in life depends on much more than your ability to learn quickly and easily? So I left the classroom and went to graduate school to become a psychologist. I started studying kids and adults in all kinds of super challenging settings. And in every study, my question was, who is successful here and why? My research team and I went to West Point Military Academy. We tried to predict which cadets would stay in military training and which would drop out. We went to the National Spelling Bee and tried to predict which children would advance farthest in competition. We studied rookie teachers working in really tough neighborhoods, asking which teachers are still going to be here in teaching by the end of the school year. And of those, who will be the most effective at improving learning outcomes for their students? We partnered with private companies, asking which of these salespeople is going to keep their jobs, and who's going to earn the most money? In all those very different contexts, one characteristic emerged as a significant predictor of success. And it wasn't social intelligence, it wasn't good looks, physical health, and it wasn't IQ. It was grit. Grit is passion and perseverance for very long-term goals. Grit is having stamina. Grit is sticking with your future, day in, day out, not just for the week, not just for the month, but for years, and working really hard to make that future a reality. Grit is living life like it's a marathon, not a sprint. A few years ago, I started studying grit in the Chicago public schools. I asked thousands of high school juniors to take grit questionnaires, and then waited around more than a year to see who would graduate. Turns out that grittier kids were significantly more likely to graduate, even when I matched them on every characteristic I could measure, things like family income, standardized achievement test scores, even how safe kids felt when they were at school. So it's not just at West Point or the National Spelling Bee that grit matters, it's also in school, especially for kids at risk for dropping out. To me, the most shocking thing about grit is how little we know, how little science knows about building it. Every day, parents and teachers ask me, how do I build grit in kids? What do I do to teach kids a solid work ethic? How do I keep them motivated for the long run? The honest answer is, I don't know. What I do know is that talent doesn't make you gritty. Our data show very clearly that there are many talented individuals who simply do not follow through on their commitments. In fact, in our data, grit is usually unrelated or even inversely related to measures of talent. So far, the best idea I've heard about building grit in kids is something called growth mindset. This is an idea developed at Stanford University by Carol Dweck, and it is the belief that the ability to learn is not fixed, that it can change with your effort. Dr. Dweck has shown that when kids read and learn about the brain and how it changes and grows in response to challenge, they're much more likely to persevere when they fail because they don't believe that failure is a permanent condition. So growth mindset is a great idea for building grit, but we need more. And that's where I'm going to end my remarks, because that's where we are. That's the work that stands before us. We need to take our best ideas, our strongest intuitions, and we need to test them. We need to measure whether we've been successful, and we have to be willing to fail, to be wrong, to start over again with lessons learned. In other words, we need to be gritty about getting our kids grittier. Thank you.
We're coming back to Carol Dweck, but not yet, okay?
So grit means having passion and perseverance, that is, wanting to get to a goal and not giving up, no matter what, until you get there.
It's all one word, right?
And it means keeping going. Tell me your first name, I forgot.
Marianne.
Oh, it's Marianne Vandell. I'm sorry, Marianne, go.
In the Midwest, when they teach people in high school, they use the old-fashioned term, and they still use it. Stick-to-itiveness, which is basically what grit is.
Right, it's exactly.
The compliment you can pay a student and say you have stick-to-itiveness.
Mm-hmm. Or perseverance. Mm-hmm. Or getting it out the door. You know, there's various ways to say it. Virginia, and then I'm going to continue.
I'm sorry. My husband is a prime example of grit. He was told when he applied to Yale University, "Mr. Gardner, you're like a car with a lot of gas and no engine." And then he went to USC and he wanted to be a professional musician. They told him he had no talent. So he went into business and he was very successful in business. Too successful for him. But anyway, that's beside the point. But now he's very creative. He's written 39 books. He's done sculpture. He's just built a museum. So all that meant nothing.
So that's a question of, he had a vision of being successful and of producing, and there were all these obstacles on the path, and they tried to get him to stop, but he hasn't stopped yet. Right? Okay. Third of my five elements in the argument, okay? And then maybe there'll be some time for some comment. This is very brief, so I don't need the microphone. This is from Smithsonian this month, January. A short interview with Kevin Ashton, of whom I'd never heard. He's the guy that coined the term the Internet of Things, which is what is just happening. That is, all your devices are going to talk to all your other devices, you know. Your smartphone is going to be able to tell your house what to do when you're away. You know, some of you already have that. But everything's going to get connected to everything else. It's going to cripple the internet. But here's the first question they asked this prominent technological innovator. What is the most important skill an innovator can have? What makes you successful as an innovator? Tenacity. The difference between successful innovators and everybody else is that innovators keep failing until they don't. I've heard that before. I've heard venture capitalists say, we don't invest in the idea, it's going to fail. They all fail. We invest in the person. Because that person is going to get another idea, and another idea, and another idea, and one of those ideas is not going to fail.
Didn't Einstein say, what? I'm not smarter than anybody else, I just stick with the problem longer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's it. Einstein said that. Yeah, I just don't give up. Yeah,
everybody has the capability, yeah. I just stay with it longer.
Yeah. Okay. Fourth, I gotta go back to this. Okay.
I'm a secret Luddite and I hate all this technology.
No, I don't. I just have mixed feelings about it. Okay, so this is the fourth step in our argument. And this was amazing to me because when they made up that psychosynthesis exercise, they didn't have this information. That exercise was probably made up in the 1970s. This is very new information, but it turns out that journey up the mountain or journey up the hill exercise is empirically supported. That is, our latest understanding of what makes success at reaching a goal is reflected in that exercise. So this is a short article from the New York Times, Sunday Review, October 24th, 2014. So just went by. It's called The Problem with Positive Thinking by Gabrielle Oettingen. Gabrielle Oettingen is a professor of psychology at New York University and the University of Hamburg, and the author of Rethinking Positive Thinking Inside the New Science of Motivation. So, Professor Oettingen says, many people think that the key to success is to cultivate and doggedly maintain an optimistic outlook. This belief in the power of positive thinking, expressed with varying degrees of sophistication, informs everything from affirmative pop anthems like Katy Perry's Roar to the Mayo Clinic's suggestion that you may be able to improve your health by eliminating negative self-talk. Okay? But the truth is that positive thinking often hinders us. More than two decades ago, I conducted a study in which I presented women enrolled in a weight reduction program with several short, open-ended scenarios about future events, and asked them to imagine how they would fare in each scenario. Some of these scenarios asked the women to imagine that they had successfully completed the program. Others asked them to imagine situations in which they were tempted to cheat on their diets. I then asked the women to rate how positive or negative their resulting thoughts and images were. So different women are being asked to imagine different things as they're enrolled in this weight reduction program. Some of them are imagining how well they did, some are imagining how they cheated. And then she gets a rating of how positive or negative their thoughts and images that they were imagining were. A year later, I checked in on these women. The results were striking. The more positively women had imagined themselves in these scenarios, the fewer pounds they actually lost. My colleague and I since performed many follow-up studies, observing a range of people, including children and adults, residents of different countries, and people with various kinds of wishes, college students wanting to date, hip replacement patients hoping to get back on their feet, graduate students looking for a job, school children wishing to get better grades. In each of these studies, the results have been clear. Fantasizing about happy outcomes, about smoothly attaining your wishes, didn't help. Indeed, it hindered people from realizing their dreams. Why? Don't go to the other direction. It isn't so simple. Why doesn't positive thinking work the way you might assume? As my colleagues and I have discovered, dreaming about the future calms you down. Dreaming about the future calms you down, measurably reducing systolic blood pressure. But it also can drain you of the energy you need to take action. In pursuing your goals. So when you imagine that you got to the top of the mountain so easily, it makes you feel good, but it takes away the energy you need to actually make the walk. In a 2011 study published in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, we asked two groups of college students to write about what lay in store for the coming week. One group was asked to imagine that the week would be great. The other group was just asked to write down any thoughts about the week that came to mind. The students who had positively fantasized reported feeling less energized than those in the control group did. As we later documented, they also went on to accomplish less during that week. If you think it's going to be smooth sailing, you actually don't have the energy for the rough seas and you don't get as far. Positive thinking fools our minds into perceiving that we've already attained our goal, slackening our readiness to pursue it. Some critics of positive thinking have advised people to discard all happy talk and get real by dwelling on the challenges or obstacles. But this is too extreme a correction. Studies have shown that this strategy doesn't work any better than entertaining positive fantasies. What does work better is a hybrid approach that combines positive thinking with realism. Here's how it works. Think of a wish. For a few minutes, imagine the wish coming true, letting your mind wander and drift where it will. Then shift gears. Spend a few more minutes imagining the obstacles that stand in the way of realizing your wish. This simple process, which my colleagues and I call mental contrasting, has produced powerful results in laboratory experiments. When participants have performed mental contrasting with reasonable, potentially attainable wishes, they've come away more energized and achieved better results compared with participants who either positively fantasized or just dwelt on the obstacles. When participants have performed mental contrasting with wishes that are not reasonable or attainable, they disengage more from those wishes. Mental contrasting spurs us on when it makes sense to pursue a wish and lets us abandon wishes more readily when it doesn't, so that we can go after other more reasonable ambitions. So thinking about the obstacles, when you realize the obstacles are impossible, maybe you need to change direction. In a recent study on healthy eating and exercise, we divided participants into two groups. Members of one group engaged in mental contrasting and then performed a planning exercise designed to help them overcome whatever obstacles stood in their way. 4 months later, members of this group were working out twice as long each week as the control group and eating considerably more vegetables. In other studies, we found that people who engaged in mental contrasting recovered better from chronic back pain, behaved more constructively in relationships, got better grades in school, and even managed stress better in the workplace. Positive thinking is pleasurable, but that doesn't mean it's good for us. Like so much in life, attaining goals requires a balanced and moderate approach, neither dwelling on the downsides nor forcing a jump for joy. So what she's saying is you want to both imagine realizing your goal and setting your intention to get there, but then also considering what the path is going to be like and what the obstacles are going to be like. So that exercise that we did, I think, is just brilliant in regard to vis-a-vis this, in that we imagine a goal at the top, and then we
address the obstacles adequately. We really have to rejoin each of the arguments and the obstacles to continue on the path to finally get to the goal. So we've anticipated the twists and turns in the road, and yet we've kept our eye on where we're going.
Nice, Spencer. Very
good. Spencer. So let's see, a couple comments, and then we go to the next thing. So let's see. First was Lynn, then we'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, okay? Lynn. Loud as you can.
Might not that be the missile contrasting? Might not that be the same as what Michael Singer proposed in his book On the Middle Way, was like a blind man with a cane feeling both the negative side and the positive side, yet he goes down to the center.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, is you just keep walking in the center, but you are pulled by the positive and you need to acknowledge the negative. So yeah, it's like... Okay, so let's see, Morty.
Where is the variable open to the possibilities of something you haven't even considered and allowing yourself that freedom to change course to some degree or moderate, like you said, either the currents or the winds or the whatever? I didn't see any of that.
No, we're talking at this point about a goal that you have decided that you're going to attain, that that you're not going to deviate from. But I think
an insight that you didn't have before because of where you've gotten to.
I understand what Morty's saying is, what about a new understanding that comes about because your mind is open, and you realize that even though I was fixed on that goal, now I understand that it would be better to go in this direction, that there's a superior goal or a goal that is superordinate to the goal that I was looking at. Yeah, I think that flexibility, you can't be rigid. I think that flexibility and openness are necessary at all points here, but not dissipation. Yeah, good. Well, point well made. Let's see. The next was Chris, and then was one more person. Who was
Peg?
Okay, and then Peg.
Twofold question. First, he seems to confirm that affirmations don't work, right?
Affirmations by themselves don't work. It just affirming, "I'm going to be," "this is going to happen," doesn't get you there because you haven't considered how to get there. So affirmations are not bad, but affirmations have to be supplemented.
Okay. And the second one is, how do harmful beliefs, deeply ingrained beliefs, interfere with this without being dealt with?
Oh, they're the things that, if you're, they'll pull you off the path. If you think you're never going to get anywhere and it's deep inside you, then no matter what you set yourself, at some point, that belief is going to torpedo you. It's going to pull you down. And for some of you, that the deepest negativity came at the closest point to the apex of the hill. That is, you go through all the possible objections and you keep going up the hill, and then when you're just about to get there, the real deal comes. Okay. So you that will, these deep beliefs will derail you unless you realize them and come to terms with them. Peg.
I love when you first started talking about mental contrasting. I'm a real visual learner, and I instantly thought of a teeter-totter. You know, it's like my path is the center of the teeter-totter, and there's going to be going this way and that way, and I acknowledge that, and I'll pay attention, but... keep on keeping on.
Yeah, so there's another, to supplement Lynn's blind person, keeping going on. This is, Peg is saying, it's like where you want to be is on the point of balance of the teeter-totter, and it's going to go this way and this way and this way, but you want to stay balanced. Yeah, so upright. Okay, next, perfect. I lie awake at night thinking about trivial things like how the hell am I going to get all this stuff into the class. Okay, so here we go. Carol Dweck, I talked about her last year. I'm going to talk about her again really briefly, but then I'm going to let her talk about her or about her work. Dweck, Carol Dweck. She wrote a bestseller called Mindset, and what she says in that book, which has made her central in education, in business, even in sports, is she said there are two ways to think about talents and abilities, such as musical ability or smarts. You can either think about them in the way we all do, the entire culture thinks about them, which is called fixed mindset. Or you can think about them in terms of the way that you should be thinking about them. That is growth mindset. Nice. Okay? Fixed mindset means from the time you were little, they gave you tests and they saw what you're doing and they said, oh, you're such a good dancer. You know, you have such a talent for dance. Or you're such a smart little girl. You have such a talent for language. Or you're such a good artist. They told some of us that we had certain talents and abilities. And the rest of us, they told to go find somewhere else where we might have more talent and ability. And we, think of school. From the time that they're 4 years old, they get A, B, C, or D, they get E, G, whatever, you know, so we're constantly told, oh, well, you know, maybe you want to kind of not go in the theoretical physics direction exactly, you might want to go in the manual arts direction, and we tell our children this. We tell our children, oh, you're so good at this, or you still have this talent or don't have this talent. That's called fixed mindset. It has two major consequences. The first of which is you're always right insecure, because the best you can do in the areas where you're talented or have ability is not screw up and verify the fact that you are, in fact, smart or talented. But so everything is a test, and the best you can do is maintain your position of having that talent. If you make a mistake, it calls into question whether you really have that talent. So you play it real safe. You don't try anything that's above your head, because then you're going to not be good enough. You're not going to have that talent. You're going to think, oh my God, I don't have the talent. So people who have these natural abilities to some extent, they don't develop them because they're afraid that they will be shown to be a fraud, to not have those abilities. So they don't develop the natural advantages they have as fully as they could. Growth mindset. Talents and abilities are like a muscle. If you work them, you will develop them. Some people have more natural muscle than others in various areas. They're going to, if they develop them, they're going to move more swiftly. But anybody can develop, at least to some extent, talents and abilities. And most of us can develop to a profound extent talents and abilities if we're willing to put the effort into developing. So if you have a growth mindset, you take on challenges that are above you, because that causes you to grow. So making mistakes is what you want to do, because you learn from those mistakes. It means that you're moving yourself up. So the growth mindset gets people the furthest, because they have the understanding that they can grow, that these things are developable. Okay, that's Carol Dweck's work in a nutshell. Let's let her tell you some of the implications of this and what she's found empirically, okay? This is real important, obviously. So here we go. I don't know why one of these lights is still on, but I will try to get it off. This is like an intelligence test. Four and I failed. But it's okay, because failing is good, right? Four out of the five of these things, the lights go off when you push it down. One out of the five, the lights go off when you push it up. Go figure. Okay, so let's go to here.
Oh, there.
The power of yet. I heard about a high school in Chicago where students had to pass a certain number of courses to graduate, and if they didn't pass a course, they got the grade not yet. And I thought that was fantastic, because if you get a failing grade, you say, I'm nothing, I'm nowhere. But if you get the grade not yet, you understand that you're on a learning curve. It gives you a path into the future. Not yet also gave me insight into a critical event early in my career, a real turning point. I wanted to see how children coped with challenge and difficulty. So I gave 10-year-olds problems that were slightly too hard for them. Some of them reacted in a shockingly positive way. They said things like, I love the challenge. Or, you know, I was hoping this would be informative. They understood that their abilities could be developed. They had what I call a growth mindset. But other students felt it was tragic, catastrophic. From their more fixed mindset perspective, their intelligence had been up for judgment, and they failed. Instead of luxuriating in the power of yet, they were gripped in the tyranny of now. So what do they do next? I'll tell you what they do next. In one study, they told us they would probably cheat the next time instead of studying more if they failed the test. In another study, after a failure, they looked for someone who did worse than they did so they could feel really good about themselves. And in study after study, they have run from difficulty. Scientists measured the electrical activity from the brain as students confronted an error. On the left, you see the fixed mindset students. There's hardly any activity. They run from the error. They don't engage with it. But on the right, you have the students with the growth mindset, the idea that abilities can be developed. They engage deeply. Their brain is on fire with yet. They engage deeply. They process the error. They learn from it, and they correct it. How are we raising our children? Are we raising them for now instead of yet? Are we raising kids who are obsessed with getting A's? Are we raising kids who don't know how to dream big dreams? Their biggest goal is getting the next A or the next test score? And are they carrying this need for constant validation with them into their future lives? Maybe because employers are coming to me and saying, we have already raised a generation of young workers who can't get through the day without an award. So, what can we do? How can we build that bridge to yet? Here are some things we can do. First of all, we can praise wisely. Not praising intelligence or talent, that has failed. Don't do that anymore, but praising the process that kids engage in. Their effort, their strategies, their focus, their perseverance, their improvement. This process praise creates kids who are hardy and resilient. There are other ways to reward yet. We recently teamed up with game scientists from the University of Washington to create a new online math game that rewarded yet. In this game, students were rewarded for effort, strategy, and progress. The usual math game rewards you for getting answers right now, but this game rewarded process. And we got more effort, more strategies, more engagement over longer periods of time, and more perseverance when they hit really, really hard problems. Just the words yet or not yet we're finding give kids greater confidence, give them a path into the future that creates greater persistence. And we can actually change students' mindsets. In one study, we taught them that every time they push out of their comfort zone to learn something new and difficult, the neurons in their brain can form new, stronger connections, and over time, they can get smarter. Look what happened. In this study, students who were not taught this growth mindset continued to show declining grades over this difficult school transition. But those who were taught this lesson showed a sharp rebound in their grades. We have shown this now, this kind of improvement, with thousands and thousands of kids, especially struggling students. So let's talk about equality. In our country, there are groups of students who chronically underperform. For example, children in inner cities or children on Native American reservations. And they've done so poorly for so long that many people think it's inevitable. But when educators create growth mindset classrooms steeped in yet, equality happens. And here are just a few examples. In 1 year, a kindergarten class in Harlem, New York, scored in the 95th percentile on the national achievement test. Many of those kids could not hold a pencil when they arrived at school. In 1 year, fourth grade students in the South Bronx, way behind, became the number one fourth grade class in the state of New York on the state math test. In a year to a year and a half, Native American students in a school on a reservation went from the bottom of their district to the top. And that district included affluent sections of Seattle. So the Native kids outdid the Microsoft kids. This happened because the meaning of effort and difficulty were transformed. Before, effort and difficulty made them feel dumb, made them feel like giving up. But now, effort and difficulty, that's when their neurons are making new connections, stronger connections. That's when they're getting smarter. I received a letter recently from a 13-year-old boy. He said, "Dear Professor Dweck, I appreciate that your writing is based on solid scientific research, and that's why I decided to put it into practice. I put more effort into my schoolwork, into my relationship with my family, and into my relationship with kids at school. And I experience great improvement in all of those areas. I now realize I've wasted most of my life. Let's not waste any more lives. Because once we know that abilities are capable of such growth, it becomes a basic human right for children, all children, to live in places that create that growth, to live in places filled with yet. Thank you.
Okay, let's... Maybe a reaction or two to this, and then I have an announcement that I definitely should not make. So let's first have a reaction or two to this, a question or comment about what you just saw, or about the argument of the morning about how it is that we can develop our capacity to reach our goals. Okay. So, David, and Larish Candid.
I'd like to know what your definition of will is and what its origin is.
That part, okay, David is asking, what is the definition of will? Will is, I'm going to make one up, okay? Will is that which, which moves our, that, will is that which moves our lives forward in healthy, authentic directions. That's not, you know, I don't know. All I know is what he said. What he said is, it's not, I want this or I don't want this. It's not a superficial thing. It's not the me that can, you know, I'm going to climb Mount Everest. It's not the... me that goes, oh God, I can't even get out of bed, you know. It's some deeper central aspect of the self that decides that this is how to live, how to proceed. And all those other things fall around. But let's see what other people say about it. Okay, so Carl is next. Carl.
Yeah, I've been hearing talks on energy. And how a lot of what our brain is doing, consciousness is the origin, energy balance, and physiology, our genes are in a contest with one another to keep us healthy, and similarly our brain. So I think, I'm thinking of will now as the amount of energy we're willing to expend to reach a goal. Yeah. And if we have, if we're only willing to put out a small amount of energy, we have very limited will or low will in that context. And if we're willing to persist, we're willing to put in a lot of energy. So I guess I'm looking at will as energy we are willing to dedicate.
Okay, so I think that I don't think will and energy are equivalent. I think that they're highly correlated. Yeah. I think will is the decision from the core. That's what he said. Will is the decision from the core. The decision that I'm going to do that no matter what. And the energy is how you get there. Jeanette.
Do you think there's a difference between the ego's will and the spiritual will?
Yeah, thank you. I knew that I should have just opened it to you guys. What he's saying here in not so many words is that the decision comes from deeper than the personality. Personality is prone to all these distortions. But the essence makes these decisions. And then the personality either cooperates or doesn't. That it supplies the energy or resists the energy. I guess you're not supposed to talk about Bill Cosby these days. But he once did a skit that you may remember about Noah. Remember the famous Noah skit?
Great skit.
And God comes to Noah and says, Noah, you got the wrong guy. Put that in. I'm just a carving. Noah. So God is saying, this is what you should be doing. This is what your mission is. And Noah is saying, no. So I guess it's kind of like that. When you, the only thing I can relate it to personally is a few times in my life, one time in my life that I'll mention right now, but there have been several. I got a phone call from my friend Neil, Crazy Neil, who, when he isn't a very good doctor, is a very insane adventurer and has broken every bone in his body and should have been dead 10 times, called up some years ago and said, would you like to go sea kayaking in the most remote section of Alaska? And I said, I've never been in a kayak in my life. And this guy, he almost killed me the last time. But something in me, deep inside of me, said, this is something more than that. This is something that you, this is a growth choice versus a fear choice, as Maslow would say. And so I said, oh my God, yes. And it was something. It was life-threatening. It was, but it fundamentally changed me, that decision. And if I'd gone the other direction, I wouldn't have known how it would be changed by that. I think that's when you really understand what will is. When there's something inside you that says, oh God, be with me now because I have that's to right. do this.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We have to break it. Okay, so this is the announcement that I did not make. Okay. There is it may be true that there may be a number of more seats, but not too many more. I don't want this recorded. There may be some more seats for Byron Katie. So if you don't have your tickets for Byron Katie, it's a week from Monday, you might want to go online and see whether you can score them, because there won't be many more. But I think that we just got some more, because it's been sold out since the day it went home, for a long time. So Claudia, and then Colette, and then we'll break. Claudia.
So does that take into account the people who are on the wait list?
I don't know. Is there a wait list for Byron Katie?
Yeah.
Oh, then I don't know how big the waiting list is. I don't know how many, but I would go online and put myself on the waiting list. I don't know anything about that. Okay, Colette.
I bought
her. Oh. Okay, Colette has one ticket if you want a ticket for Byron Katie. Okay, anybody else? Okay. I would get on the waiting list. I think there are about 70 seats more. So get on the waiting list if that's the way you do it. Okay, we're adjourned for the day.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Family together.